Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping the future, live or on demand. I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, the G20 ends with progress on paper, but some tension in the room. Amnesty International warns government that climate failures are drowning the poor. Big banks paddling into 2025 with tight margins, and e-commerce reshapes retail as online food purchases jump 47%. It's Monday, the 24th of November. Now, Johannesburg's G20 is over, the declaration is signed, and South Africa is calling it a victory for multilateralism and the global south, even as the United States boycotted the summit and refused to back the deal. The 122-point declaration puts debt relief, climate finance, and critical minerals on the table, but it also leaves, I think, some tough questions unanswered, particularly around the implementation and geopolitics. Well, let's get a broad assessment after the event. Bloomberg's Anthony Squazine is with me. Anthony, a very warm welcome. If you had to sum up the G20 then, did South Africa deliver or disappoint?
I think that South Africa made the best of a pretty bad situation. And I think that the president, Ramaphosa, can come out of this with some credibility. The U.S. not being here and boycotting the event was problematic, but the fact that they got a declaration through against the U.S.'s objections, backed by just about every country aside from a slight objection from Argentina, I think is pretty impressive.
Let me pick you up on the United States. As you say, boycotting the summit, refusing to endorse the declaration. Practically, though, how much does that undercut, do you think, what was agreed in Johannesburg? How serious a blow was it?
Well, it is a blow, but I listened to a press conference yesterday held by Mark Carney, the Prime Minister of Canada, and he spoke about the declaration, and he said, look, even in the absence of the U.S., countries representing three-quarters of the world's population, two-thirds of its economy, and three-quarters of international trade endorsed the declaration. So therefore, it does carry weight. Those are his words. And I think that's true. He also spoke about shifting centers of gravity, economic gravity globally. The U.S. is still enormously important, but it's not the giant it once was. There are other powers as well. There's China, there's India. And you have a lot of middle powers. The European nations are making their voices a bit more heard than they used to. And they also have some clout. And in addition to that, you have the Middle East and UAE and Saudi Arabia also trying to make themselves heard.
It was always going to be difficult from the get-go, given that South Africa didn't have Washington at the table. And it was, as you say, testament to handling diplomacy, given that absence.
Yes, it was. I think it was quite difficult. And, you know, the U.S. At the 11th hour suggesting their deputy ambassador to South Africa could come and receive the handover from Ramaphosa was a testing moment. And I think the South African government did the right thing in saying he wasn't suitably senior and therefore barring them from doing that. But it was another, you know, another petty spat between the two countries, and it was an unwelcome distraction.
Let's talk practically. On paper, Anthony, how big a deal is the declaration then in terms of those three issues I mentioned at the start, debt relief, climate finance, and critical minerals? Are there concrete wins that South Africa can credibly claim?
Well, at the end of all these summits, the COP summits, G20 summits, we always have these very lengthy declarations. And practically, they're just declarations, and they may not come to pass. But I do think the fact that South Africa set a clear set of priorities at the beginning of the year when it took over, and at the end of the year when the declaration came out, all of those have been included. I think that is important, and it's a victory. I also think that we have seen a few announcements that basically chime with South Africa's aims. So we saw Ursula von der Leyen on Friday pledging another €7 billion toward African renewable energy projects. And we saw the UAE over the weekend making an announcement that they will spend $1 billion over the next 5 years on various artificial intelligence projects around Africa to improve provision of health and various other public goods. So I think those are very positive. But no, I mean, if you look at the declaration, it doesn't really go into the nitty-gritty of how everything will be implemented. So we'll have to see if those come to pass. And also, I must say, we're passing over the baton to the US next year, which will be the host and president of the G20. And I'm sure they'll do their best to undo a lot of these things because they really are against their own agenda.
And it's the nitty-gritty which is absolutely critical. I guess when the dust settles, poorer or indebted nations are going to ask if anything changes in the next 12 to 14 or 12 to 24 months. Or, as you've suggested, a lot of this is still aspiration.
I think it's mostly aspiration, but nevertheless, we have seen progress in recent years, and I think that it's a step forward.
What do you think fell short? What were we unable to resolve? A lot of time, I think, was spent talking about Ukraine. I'm not sure to what extent Gaza was mentioned, or even broader reform of global financial institutions.
I think if we start off with the conflict, I saw in the declaration there was a rather brief mention of a handful of conflicts: Congo, Sudan, Gaza, and Ukraine. They didn't really go into a lot of depth on those. And I think the reason for that may well have been that they are thorny issues and they might have derailed the declaration. So that, I think, is falling short. The issue of Ukraine, it was a bit of a sideshow and it became a subplot at the G20, given that Donald Trump's administration had launched this 28-point peace plan for Russia and Ukraine without informing their allies, especially those in Europe. So there were lots of hurried meetings between the various presidents and prime ministers of European nations, along with Japan and Canada. And I think that detracted from the whole thing a little bit. So that was an issue. In terms of reform of global finance and financial institutions, I think it's a work in progress. These things are not easy to resolve, but the World Bank is slowly moving toward providing more finance for development projects. I mean, I've spoken to the president of the World Bank twice this year, and they really do have an emphasis on bringing up more money for renewable energy, education, and other development priorities. And a lot of that money will be going toward Africa. So I think that's a general push from the global community.
And Anthony, through what prism should South African business be viewing both the G20 and the B20 that preceded it?
Well, I think it's been a good opportunity for them to showcase themselves on the global stage. The B20 went very well. Despite the US boycotting the political part, the G20 itself, the U.S. companies played a strong role in the B20 and, you know, expressed their interest in continuing to do business with South Africa. So I think it was positive. You know, it's all over now and it's been handed off. But I think we've had a year where nothing terrible happened and nothing really went wrong. And I've been told by various people who've attended previous G20 summits that R1 was actually extremely well run, which is, it's a pleasant surprise because, you know, we all live in Johannesburg. Well, a lot of us do. And this is not in the greatest state, but I think we managed to pull it off.
And just finally, on a broader canvas, for South Africans listening, why, Anthony, should they care about what happened this past weekend? Is there one big thing that you'll be watching that could actually affect jobs, investment, and growth at home?
Well, again, it's a little bit intangible, but I think that the way the summit was conducted, the fact that our president and the government came out with credibility, they handled the situation well, I think that's good for us. It's an advert for South Africa. We've had a lot of very important prime ministers and presidents here in South Africa looking for themselves. I mean, I spoke to a Japanese minister who was here, and she hadn't been to South Africa for 30 years. She was pleasantly surprised. That can only all go well for us in the future. And there are all sorts of small announcements. Canada has set up an office in Cape Town, or is about to set up an office in Cape Town, to promote Canadian-South African trade. I think a few of those will ultimately be positive. But no, I don't think there's any big bang. We're not going to see a step change in the economy or a sudden flood of investment, but we should overall be beneficiaries.
And I suppose we should be grateful that the road lights are working on the R24 highway to OR Tambo International. Anthony Skwazin from Bloomberg, thank you very much indeed. I appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
A new Amnesty International report warns that government climate failures are leaving informal settlement residents literally flooded and forgotten. With major metros facing rising climate-driven flooding, the report accuses authorities of systemic neglect and human rights violations. It is a serious report, and let's get to grips with it with Cassandra Doraisamy from Amnesty International. So, Cassandra, the report is very blunt. Government failures are putting lives at risk. Are you able to tell me which failure is the most severe?
Well, the report situates the vulnerabilities that people are facing in informal settlements as part of the broader housing crisis in South Africa. So the first failure is the failure to adequately deal with the legacy of apartheid spatial planning, to deal with the legacy of colonialism. And as much as those are inherited issues that South Africa has received from its past, successive democratic governments have not been able to adequately deal with the issue. And it's acknowledged in government's own white paper on human settlements that the crisis of housing has gotten worse post-apartheid. So that's the first issue that we look at, is the right to adequate housing, because that frames the vulnerabilities that we speak of. The second is in the context of climate change and increasing flooding that's increasing with intensity and frequency, people living in informal settlements are often left vulnerable because of the poor infrastructure that they have around them. And in those situations, our report looks at instances where government has not responded to people who are in dire crisis because of flooding. And that's why we use the title Flooded and Forgotten, because often people are left to fend for themselves, are left to rely on NGOs, and are left feeling forgotten by government.
And we know that flooding is both predictable and recurring. One's got to ask the question why disaster planning has not materially improved.
Well, South Africa has a good framework for disaster management and disaster risk reduction. The issue is then, of course, as we say in so many other areas, law, it's in the implementation and in the lack of coordination at times between different governments, because this disaster risk response requires, it requires social development to be involved, sometimes health, sometimes home affairs. It's so many different departments that need a coordinated response to a disaster. But also the fact that some rains and some flooding doesn't receive a disaster response. And it's those instances that we also focus on, because, yes, there are the big moments. There's the 2022 floods. There was the floods in the Eastern Cape earlier this year that led to 100 people dying. And those get a lot of attention and receive quicker responses. But there's also the ordinary, quote-unquote, ordinary, regular rains that happen. And people, communities told us, that it's in those moments where they have to fend for themselves and figure out how to manage the situation and don't receive any support from government.
And in that respect, government often blames budget limits. I wonder if your evidence shows if it's a funding problem or just a question of not being able to prioritize correctly.
Well, our report didn't conduct a budget analysis per se, but what we do show in the report is just the incredible vacancy rate. So the lack of human resources that are going into government departments that are part of the response. And linked to that is the budget issue, that there's not enough overall resources, financial, human, technical, to respond to crises. And one of our recommendations is that there is this infusion of both financial and human resources and technical expertise into all areas of government that are responsible for planning and for response, because we need to be proactive at this stage as well. And for that infusion, especially to be in local government that's severely undercapacitated to deal with the response, and local government is often at times at the coalface of responding to disaster.
A short-term response that we read about is temporary relocation areas, but I wonder whether they solve anything or simply entrench new human rights violations.
Well, temporary relocation areas are, and we refer to it in our report, that many partners just refer to them as government-sanctioned informal settlements. And oftentimes people are moved there and left there for years on end. And these are meant to be temporary. They're meant to be for 6 months at a time. They're not intended for people to live there for years on end. One of the cases we look at was in Etequini, where people in the 2022 floods were moved to a temporary relocation in Lamontville, and during this year's floods were flooded again. So it was government essentially moving them from one risky area to another risky area. And sadly, in that instance of floods this year, five people died. And when we spoke to the community, they told us the horror of trying to save as many people as they can from across the road who had been moved there. And it's really traumatic, but it says a lot about government's planning efforts and that there needs to be more foresight and more intentionality in the planning that goes into relocating people, not just in the time, which is very important that people spend there, but also in the areas that they have been moved to.
It's not only foresight and intentionality. Surely we need more solid mechanisms to force municipalities to act, often when political will is missing or it's just a simple inadequate response.
And that's so important. It's that accountability. How do we hold governments accountable to their responsibilities and their obligations under the Constitution and other existing laws and mechanisms? And one of the things is that next year is local government elections. How are we as people thinking about this issue of disaster risk management, this issue of planning in the context of climate change as an issue that we need to hold politicians and hold governments accountable to make it an issue that people think about and engage with their officials on ahead of the next local government election?
Just a final one, and apologies, it's a very broad question, but what do you think real climate justice looks like for people in informal settlements beyond the rhetoric that we hear all the time?
I will refer back to what we heard in communities, because I think real justice for them, at least from what we heard, is you know, firstly having safe, adequate housing, and that housing is going to protect them against the elements of flooding and rains, and that whenever it floods, people are not left stranded or having property damaged or losing days of income because they can't leave their home due to the rains, or even children losing days of school because of this. The justice has to be linked to the conditions in which people live, and that starts with adequate housing and climate resilient housing.
Thank you very much indeed, Cassandra Dorasamy from Amnesty International. I appreciate your time today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Let's move on to financial services now. And the latest BDO Tier 1 Banking Peer Report paints a picture of South Africa's big banks paddling into next year with tight margins but lower credit losses, strong digital growth and rising earnings from the rest of the continent. Return on equity is holding up, loan growth is ticking along and credit quality has improved even as the economy struggles to grow at around 1%, as well as interest rate cuts and a squeeze on traditional lending margins. Well, let's pull all of that together. I'm in conversation now with Kevin Hoff, banking sector leader at BDO South Africa. Kevin, if you had to sum it up and welcome to you in a sentence, how did our major banks really perform this year?
Thank you, Jeremy. Overall, the banks for the past year have performed strongly. We've seen good loan growth, around 7% coming through for them. Good management of costs, although we've seen sort of that stabilize. And importantly, we've seen a decline in the credit loss ratios across the banks, meaning that they generally have been exposed to lower credit risk and managing their credit risk better.
Let's pick up on those credit loss ratios. Is it just better asset quality in this environment, do you think?
I think it's a combination of better asset quality. I think we're seeing the provisions coming off a higher base in 2024. But overall, we are seeing non-performing loans on average also reducing around 5% across the sector, which indicates better quality assets, which comes in combination with better credit risk management and acceptance processes across the board.
Net interest margins are under pressure, as the report says. How difficult then, Kevin, is it for banks to protect profitability going forward?
In the current environment of declining interest rates, it has been difficult for the banks, which has led to that net interest margin compression. Although that being said, they've counteracted that well through non-interest revenue. So really looking at revenue from different streams, such as wealth businesses, we've seen bigger revenues coming through the investment banks on larger structured deals. And I think importantly, we've seen across a number of the larger banks, good contributions from Africa, where the current macroeconomics in South Africa are slightly different.
Well, let me pick you up on non-interest revenue, and then we can talk about Africa. How significant is that shift for the Big Six? Is there a ceiling on this type of push forward?
It has become significant, and in particular within the corporate and investment banking segments. It is going to continue to be important for the banks to really sustain profitability. From a ceiling perspective, difficult to set an exact ceiling. I think with the positivity in the market, in particular in segments of the mining, infrastructure, renewable energy, those typically would generate larger non-interest revenues as well. So certainly we are expecting that to continue over the next year.
And African expansion is a big issue for next year. I think you write that around 30% of earnings are now offshore.
Correct. Across Standard Bank and Absa in particular, those are greater than 30%, with some of the other banks lagging that slightly. But certainly, we're seeing larger contributions of the African businesses across the board.
Could you put the figure of 21 million digital users into some kind of perspective for me and what it means for how banks are actually making money?
Sure. So we're seeing that number increasing over the past 3 years that we've been monitoring across our reports. And it really talks to the digital strategies across the banks, where they are certainly using digital not just internally for cost optimization anymore, but really moving that to customer-centric models. So creating broader customer ecosystems and platform-based banking, which ultimately is driving customers into digital interfaces and really trying to leverage not just banking with a customer, but various other services. So that number certainly is expected to increase as the banks continue to really push their digital agendas to grow the client bases and pivot them from bricks and mortar type branch activity into digital bases now.
But what it also tells us, I imagine, is the Big Six will be under more pressure given that some of the newer fintechs are seemingly a lot more adept and nimble.
Correct. And that's certainly the challenge the Big Six that we've focused in our report this time will certainly face in terms of competing. What we have seen, though, in particularly the segment of these six is a number of partnerships and acquisitions of fintechs. So the bigger banks appear to be using those as a mechanism to really compete and break in and gain customer bases and technology compared to some of the more digital banking competitors.
Kevin, let me circle back to corporate and investment banking. I think you said delivering over 21% of ROE. Maybe just flesh out for me a little as to where that growth is coming from specifically.
Yeah, sure. So we've seen net interest income growing around 7% in the CIB space, which is also supplemented with a non-interest revenue on average grew around just over 5%. And we're seeing good, strong loan growth as well within the segment. And then that's particularly driven from an increase of activity within the energy and infrastructure finance segments, where government spending and a move to the infrastructure spending has really helped them. We saw loans grow around 7% across the CIB market for the last year, which has really driven that growth.
And just a final one, for ordinary customers, the resilience that you've outlined for us, does it ultimately translate into better pricing and easier access to credit?
Yeah, thanks. It's always a good question, and I think we are seeing an increase in appetite from the banks to extend credit, and that's across the segments, which naturally will allow customers access to better products and better pricing from a competitive environment. As you noted earlier, the banks are under pressure from the digital banks, which would generally translate into the banks having to be more competitive in their pricing. So I do think it's overall positive for the consumers, but with interest rates remaining low, it does restrict the banks in terms of those net interest margins. But certainly, I think you'll see better value-added services being offered by the banks.
Kevin Hoff, banking sector leader, BDO, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa's retail landscape is changing fast and food is leading the charge. Absa's latest data shows online food spending surging by 47% year on year, and that is far outpacing in-store growth. And e-commerce, I read, is going to top 130 billion rand this year, and convenience is quickly becoming the new battleground. Well, let's discuss this trend in a little more detail. James Noble is with me, sector executive for wholesale, retail and franchising at Absa Business Banking. James, a very warm welcome to you. So online food spending growing massively, as I've just mentioned. What is driving this level of acceleration?
So even before COVID, especially on the restaurant, quick service restaurant side, we started seeing that surge or increase in home deliveries. But the pandemic or COVID-19 actually is the primary driver of increasing online sales, especially in your grocery retail environment. So the pandemic was definitely the main driver. We were stuck at home. People were looking for convenience. And lately, I think it's more about a case of avoiding long queues.
My next question that I jotted down was to ask you whether it's sustainable. But as you answered that question, I don't think it's not only sustainable, but it's probably going to accelerate even further as we become more comfortable with this convenient way of living.
Definitely. And I think, I mean, you mentioned in the numbers there that the growth year on year is far outpacing what's happening in stores. So your in-store currently is roughly about 2% year on year compared to what you mentioned earlier, the 47% for online spend. Obviously, it's coming from a much smaller base. But I think if you look at the numbers, it definitely starts adding up over the last couple of years.
That 2% is interesting because we've seen this rapid expansion of dark stores, and surely that risks hollowing out traditional retail formats. And I would imagine the chains are maybe battling a little bit to get their heads around that.
Yeah, your traditional bricks and mortar retail stores, as we know it, it's quite expensive to operate them. And if you look at the dark store initiative that started now recently, a lot of these bigger retailers are moving towards the dark store concept because obviously they don't have to be in primary retail spots, and therefore they can look at second tier locations as long as it's still close to the consumer. And obviously it becomes much cheaper for them to deliver their goods to the consumers.
Let's go back to the online dynamic. I read that delivery fees and product freshness remain top consumer complaints. Why, I wonder, has the sector not solved basic things like this?
I think that's one of the biggest concerns in the industry is that, and obviously they're all working towards even better technology and even get closer to the consumer, because the closer you are to the consumer, the quicker you can deliver. I think also if you look at your restaurant and quick service restaurant deliveries, especially if you want to order food, you want hot food when they deliver it. So yeah, by fine-tuning the technology, they obviously looking into solving those type of challenges that they are experiencing.
And James, in that respect, you talk about better technology, and obviously AI is being hyped as a retail game changer. From what you see, what is real and what is just marketing?
It's definitely real. It's not just marketing. So, and I think if you look at all the big retailers and even your smaller retailers and your local retailers, they all start looking at using AI technology. You can even partner with your bank like APSA, and we've got an analytics tool, Pocket Flow, where the retailers can actually get much more info about their customers, where they're from, what their age groups are, gender, and so forth. And that also helps the retailer to obviously plan better for what products they need to have in stock for their clients. But also it helps them to personalize offerings to their clients as well. So it's definitely very real currently.
And critical that smaller retailers start looking at tools like that. But the complaint, I guess, would be that many of them say they just can't afford automation. And that shift maybe creates the risk of a two-tier retail economy, which is a real problem.
I think most of you... So if you look at the banks as well, we try and support especially your smaller SMEs. So your big corporates, obviously, they've got the cash flow and the capital to invest into very expensive technology. But again, like if you look at APSA, we've got ShopRate. So it's an offering on the back of our card acquiring solution where we actually assist smaller SMEs to set up the e-commerce platform so that they can then equally compete with your big corporate retailers as well.
James, many township and maybe peri-urban areas still face patchy service as we go back to the online delivery dynamic. Do you think the rollout of online food shopping is widening or narrowing inequality?
The township economy is quite a big economy in South Africa, and all the retailers are focusing on the township economy and the rural economy as well. So it's definitely growing. And if you chat with your delivery services companies, they're all looking at how can they also then take part in that economy and how can they then also bring the products much closer and much quicker to your township environment. So yeah, it's definitely growing.
Well, e-commerce, as I mentioned, expected to exceed 130 billion rand this year. So this is a very real debate. James Noble, thank you very much indeed. Sector Executive, Wholesale, Retail and Franchising at APSA Business Banking. Thank you very much indeed. And that is our program for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb. Your trusted source for business and investment insights.